screenwriter, playwright, and stage director, and she also has some premonitions in regards to the terrorists and Al-Qaeda. Now, that's interesting. You had predicted some terrorist scenarios. Perhaps you can tell us about that.
Well, it's good to be with you, Walt, and I'd love to talk about it because I wasn't trying to crystal ball anything. I was just trying to see how I, as an actress after 9/11, could help not only my country but perhaps sort out why we seem to be so divided rather than united. We were united for a short period of time, and then we started dividing on so many issues to the point today where the level of debate is hysterical. There's so much anger and vitriol. And so I started to connect the dots of our current events through the eyes of the actual enemy. I had discovered through research that the Israelis had warned us that the true mastermind of Al-Qaeda is an Egyptian psychiatrist by the name of Ayman al-Zawahiri. And so in looking through his eyes, using the type of research that an actress would use, and I had many times in my career to play real people, with his motivation, a different picture emerged. And so I started to write down what I was seeing and started to use imagination to say, well, if that's the case, then I'll start to see the following types of things happening in the United States or internationally. And then they started happening. And that's when I knew that I had figured out what this enemy was doing to us.
Well, that's very interesting. And what kind of research did you actually do to discover this and to find out more about these people?
Well, when one is an actor and you're playing any character, really, but if you're playing a real person, you have the advantage of being able to look into some of their background by researching it to get the backstory of their past life. And what you're looking to do is identify their driving motivation, which you cull, if you will, from what they've done in the past, what they've been. You give a prediction of what their likely driving motivation. We all have a purpose. We all have a motivation. And his revealed a very interesting one to me, which is a little bit different probably from what our government would think. I don't think the man is motivated at all by religion. And his training and background, which shows up in research on internet and news about him and so on, exposed a different angle. And when I put that into play, then the various actions that Al-Qaeda was taking, that he had taken, things that we were experiencing began to make a whole lot of sense. Though I knew it was probably correct. So that's where I started.
Well, years ago, some religious leaders were predicting a holy war would be the major war coming up. And it looks to me like some of the extremists have already got that started somewhat.
Yes, and that would be extremists. In this particular case, I think the point of my stories and my novels, and certainly the readers believe it, is that this guy is using fear as a major weapon. He's fighting primarily a propaganda war against us in order to hit us economically. But there's no question that if one can divert one's attention to get religions warring with religions and get into actual physical military wars, which we are, and there are some justifications for it. It's not about that. Those things are legitimately in the mix. But that's the diversion which is pulling our attention and aggravating and upsetting people so much, and we're missing the main attack line, in my opinion, which is the economic attack on the United States.
Well, especially with Afghanistan, other countries have had wars over there, and nobody's ever won anything.
Exactly. I think that thousands of years of history have proven that religions warring against religions and tribes and so on, it doesn't resolve that. A resolution is possible there, but it's going to have to come in different ways. But I think Zawahiri's smart enough to know that he can use his religion to get young men to volunteer to fight and die.
Now, in your book, you surmise that the Osama bin Laden may be in Iran. We've been looking for him for a long time. He's been very elusive, and for all we know, he might be dead by this time, and just his reputation carries on.
Yes, in fact, in early on, my personal opinion was that he died in December of 2001. I left him alive in my stories because they play on the mystery of, well, if he's alive, how did they pull off this filmmaking and the radio interviews and everything? And that's part of the mystery of my books. But I did surmise that if he were alive, he will be under the control of Zawahiri, and they will use an old military strategy of hiding in plain sight. And Iran is a place he could have gone to or been taken to, where we would not have had any eyes on the ground or any eyes of any sort, really, to find him. We've been looking elsewhere for him, but in my mysteries, so to speak, they're both hiding in plain sight in different parts of the world.
Now, what are some of the similarities in your fiction books that actually correspond with actual events?
Well, most recently, of course, with the new book that's out, White King Rising, that has been, I think, pretty startling to people, because the day I was doing a pre-launch book signing for it, the Fort Hood shooting occurred, and when one reads the book, they realize that I lay out in there the mechanism that a guy like this would use, as did the Soviets, to control one's mind enough to turn them into a killer that would pick up and shoot in the workplace, or in this case, the Fort Hood shooter. And so the Fort Hood shooting occurred right at the time that people were just beginning to read about that we would start to have young professional men, Americans, converted into and turning themselves into a type of suicide killer. Also, the biggest one, though, the opening chapters of White King Rising are about the restaging and relocation of Al-Qaeda into Latin America in a deal involving Cuba, Venezuela, the drug cartels, and the terrorists. And I had put that in the stories, of course, even before the book came out, obviously. And now, of course, the Americans are looking at that square in the eyes now. It's not just a border issue. They're looking at, oh, my Lord, the terrorists are down there, and they're linked with the drug cartels. And that's a lot of military and counter-terrorist people have a lot of attention on both my books, because my stories are, you know, fiction can be truer than fact, and my stories are almost more plausible to them than what they've been discovering in some of their own intelligence and analysis.
Well, some of this is rather uncanny, too, of what you've come out with here, fiction-wise, and
yeah,
and its application to the present day today.
Oh, yeah. Well, to be honest with you, it spooked me a little bit way back in 2004 when I started into this and I realized I was so accurate, because I didn't know, I couldn't just call up Washington, you know, and say, hey, this actress has figured something out and you ought to pay attention to me. So I had to find a way to reveal it to the American public and to, you know, military intelligence, whoever, in a way that would seem plausible to them. So I decided to use the fiction format. And what I had my attention most on from 2004 to now was the internal decay in the United States, the dumbing down and drugging up of America, if you will. And my attention on Generation Y, this the young people in their teens and 20-somethings that are about to take the baton. And the Soviets knew that if they could take them down, we're gone, two generations in a row. And I believe this man is attacking along that line, which is why there's so many attacks in education, family, religion, almost all of our institutions are under attack. And my second book is about that Trojan horse, who did it, how they're doing it, why, and how to win.
So then Generation Y is extremely important, not only in your book, but in the future.
I believe so, that our future as a people and what happens in America, of course, determines, I believe, what happens in the rest of the world. What happens here is now coming crashing onto their lines. And this is a generation that is called the trophy generation, because they are regarded that they can't take loss or failure or defeat or discouragement, so they're given trophies just for showing up. Well, my premise is that they're going to have to turn themselves into the hero generation, because whether they want it or not, this fight is coming to them. And if they have been drugged up and dumbed down and undereducated in certain areas, we're softer. And I think this enemy knows that. He's very brilliant, and he's attacking along the same lines the Soviets did. These are totalitarians. These are not people interested in God and religion.
It's almost like history repeating itself.
Yes, exactly, until we learn from it. So I was hoping that by the time people come through these stories, they have learned something new. They've seen their current events, but they just see it with a different light. And as they see it, they go, ah, I can handle that now that I'm looking at what the real picture is and not what the camouflaged one is. We can learn. We're a very bright people.
Well, Well, you mentioned the Trojan horse, too, but what about your references to the fifth column? What do you mean by that?
Well, in military terms, that is a force inside a country that is about to be attacked, whose purpose is sabotage and to break the solidarity of that country. Then any attacking columns from the outside could prevail. And that was actually what I tripped up on, that if we were dividing, that would have to come from a strategy of divide and conquer. And I just asked myself, well, if I were going to try to divide and conquer America, how would I do that? And it would have to be fifth column. So the whole mystery of the first book is, who is that fifth column and who set them in motion and are they even aware of it? And, of course, as time has gone on here, we have become more and more divisive and more hostile, which kind of bears, it's the fruit on the tree, really, of that fifth column.
Well, it amazes me that you have such insight into this, especially, well, like you say, you did a lot of studying, too, being an actress. And you're right, I did some acting myself, and you do have to do a lot of research about the person you're going to be playing or the play itself.
Right.
And but it amazes me the insight going into this particular subject. It seems odd that you would focus on this.
Yeah, I know that. I do understand that. But I think all of us on that day, and of course we're just after the 9th anniversary on it now, I stood there and I looked and asked myself, what can I do to help? Because if there's any message I would have for Americans is that we all have to weigh in now and not to assume that we don't have something to bring to the table. I have a background in business. I have a background in marketing. I've been a student of the mind. And that, coupled with the acting background, just enabled me to say to myself, well, what I can bring to the table is creative imagination. And America was accused of lacking imagination in the months and years leading up to 9/11. And so I said, well, I can bring that creative imagination. I can bring an ability to research. This guy's bright. The Israelis say that this man is the most dangerous man on the planet, and they can't figure him out. But maybe I can. And in this case, it appears I have. But I would encourage none of us to, I don't think any of us should assume we don't have something to bring to the table that will help us pull out of this.
Well, were you in New York when 9/11 occurred?
I was in Los Angeles at that time. I live in Montana now, but in 9/11 I was primarily in Los Angeles, sometimes living in New York. But I have family in New York City and a lot of friends there, so I'm very familiar with the island.
Well, a friend of mine who at the time worked for Liz Claiborne was living just a few blocks from there, too, and that incident has affected her a lot. She still thinks about it a lot.
Oh, there's no question. Yeah. It was a devastating, it was a brilliant military surprise attack, but a devastating attack. To have that occur on American soil, I would hope that no one in government or no one in the public undervalues what that would mean from an enemy viewpoint in terms of their propaganda, their public relations, for them to have pulled off something like that. That's a statement of the magnitude of their intentions.
Well, it's interesting to note, too, that back in World War II, that when Pearl Harbor was bombed, the U.S. did have an inkling that that was going to happen, but didn't do anything about it.
Yeah, well, that doesn't surprise me, and I'm not even, you know, I'm not hostile to government, but the way we have such a free country set up here, and we're a good people and not that necessarily suspicious of people, that even our government, when they know what could happen, cannot necessarily step forward and take a preemptive action on someone who has not demonstrated a hostility to us. The American people can't think with that. They are not in agreement with that. Now, once we're hit and we've been struck, then we'll fight back. But it didn't surprise me at all that, you know, I can just imagine if President Clinton or President Bush had tried to come, but particularly if Clinton had tried to come and say, no, by the way, I think we need to go, you know, invade another country, we would have said, no. After the attack, we realized that the enemy was there. That didn't happen overnight. That had been developing for a long time. And now we were hit. And now what are we going to do?
Let's change hats for a moment here and talk about your career, too, and let our listeners know a little bit more about you.
I would be happy to.
As a producer and an actress, what were some of the shows you were in, and you've done a lot of television as well.
Yes, I did mostly television. I've been in the industry for 35 years, and I had the opportunity to have recurring roles on Matlock, where I played the prosecutor, and on Hill Street Blues. And I did just dozens of guest starring roles in wonderful shows like the Barney Millers and the Lou Grants and L.A. Law. But I began early on. My first movie was a film called Collision Course with Henry Fonda and E.G. Marshall, where I was playing Margaret Truman. It was the story of the conflict between Truman and MacArthur. And so that was my first taste of being a real person, so to speak, as an actress, but also getting to work with some heavyweights. And I've had the privilege of working with Peter O'Toole and Creator. And I was in Roots. And there is an example of, you know, a fictitious novel based on the actual events of and inspired by the actual events of his family, but a novel that changed the way America viewed itself, the way people view their heritage and so on. That gave me, that allowed me to think that, yes, if you write the right kind of novel, you can impact a country and make a difference.
So as an artist, you're actually combining the two right now. Do you plan to do additional TV shows or movies in addition to writing these books, and do you plan more books?
I plan the third one in the White King series. I had initially expected that by the time people read White King Rising, it was solved. There's a solution in there, and we can handle this very, very quickly, frankly. The solution is shockingly simple. So I thought I was done until I got into the book signings and I realized there was one question yet unanswered, and that was who sent that Trojan horse? So there's going to be a third in that series for sure. Plus, I love writing, the freedom of where I can live. I will do some acting again, but I tend to be oriented, Walt, more towards my own projects. I need to have the freedom to create things that have a statement that I want to make. I love to entertain, but I also want it to be something that uplifts the public, that enlightens the audience in some way. I don't like to just do acting for acting's sake. It always, for me, has to be something where somebody benefits in a big way, especially right now.
Well, you talked about Generation Y, too. Do you think that it's going to be narrowed down to a few people in society that actually will be running the country? As the rate we're going with the government restrictions and that sort of thing, how do you feel about that?
I am very, very concerned that that would be the direction our government is moving, and that we have been psychologically manipulated into accepting, and that that would be extremely dangerous. It would mean the end of our form of government, and there's no question in my mind that somebody has that intention. And I learned from a Czech filmmaker long ago, a man who did, he was the director on the film Creator, because one day on the set he said, "Lee, do you know how to cook a frog?" And I said, "As a matter of fact, I do, because I have a business coach who was teaching me that America was being cooked." And that's that whole premise that if you put the frog in cold water and you just turn the heat up slightly, a little bit at a time, he doesn't notice that he's in mortal danger. He's just warming up. By the time his body recognizes that he's in mortal danger, it's too late. He can't jump out. But if you drop him in hot water, he'll recognize that he's fast enough to jump out. And so I, when I talk with Generation Y, I love to explain to them, look, the baton is coming to you in the country. You know you're gearing up to be adults in life and starting your families and getting out of college and going to college and starting careers. But more than that, the World War II generation is passing away. My generation, the baby boom generation, is beginning to pass away, but we're definitely, you know, at the retirement stages. And it's now coming to you as you step up in the line to be able to run corporations, contribute in your towns and cities, assume political office, because you are going to face that adversary, this and any future ones, and you also have to wisely enough understand your country and what it means and who we are and what we stand for. So I love to talk to the young people because they're eager ears. Now, here's the good news. They're eager ears. And when they recognize that maybe some of this was left out in school or wasn't emphasized enough or maybe even some false information, they will reach for the research because I think they're just like we were when we were younger. And that is, they want to do well and they want to contribute. And they know something's wrong and they're looking for how can they help? How can they get in the game?
Well, I think this is evident, too, when you take a look at the amount of people who vote. It's usually the older people who are the ones that go to the polls, and the younger people don't necessarily go to the polls or have that enthusiasm about political candidates.
Yes, I think that's been true in the past. I think the last election, regardless of how somebody feels about it, that the last election, more of them did turn out. And so it's not a question of which party. It's a question of just educating them, I think, on the responsibilities of citizenship. See, I couldn't wait. When I turned 21, I could not wait to get out to vote because I had been taught that by my parents. And I had been given an appreciation of not only our country, but that I had a responsibility to weigh in, and the very least any of us can do is vote. And it is possible to make a difference. I mean, good Lord, if one actress can decide to, you know, weigh in and somehow figure out things that the counterterrorist people or military intelligence couldn't, why would somebody assume that their one vote wouldn't matter, particularly in local issues and regional issues and so on?
Well, I know what you mean about voting, too. I was the same way. And in those days, you had to be 21, as you say,
yeah,
to vote. And it was the same thing with me. I could hardly wait to get out and vote. And then I was involved with a political action group, too, as a kid, you know, for Kids for Ike, or I forget what it was. But I go back that far.
A little bit farther than me. Well, and see, when you start young, learning and listening and getting involved, then it's an easy thing for you to realize, oh, okay, what would I do if I were in that person's position? If we turn into nothing but a nation of victims and complainers, we're not going to make it through this thing. But if we take whatever it is that we're experiencing that might be negative and learn from it and decide to make better decisions that lead us out in a better path, we'll be fine. But that's going to be people who say, well, I'm going to be responsible here. I have to think, what would I be doing if I were president? What would I be doing if I had run for, let's say, the Congress in my district, and I was the congressman that's now having to handle these bills? And when they do that, I think they'll realize, man, there's more that I would need to know.
Now, right now we have a volunteer army and a volunteer service, whatever branch you want to go into. Do you think that the draft would be something that should be brought back again as a protection for the United States?
I personally don't, because I have the opportunity, particularly up in Montana, to meet with the young professionals up here. And anytime there's a professional, they have chosen to do it. And I think when the young men and women elect that right now, they understand their country, they also understand the threats against it, and they are willing to put time and energy and possibly even their life on the line to protect it. That's very different from someone who really doesn't want to be there. And frankly, if it were me and I was in combat, I would want to make certain that the guys with me wanted to be there. Not that I'm not saying that they want to be because they're in danger, but that they want to be there because it's a responsibility that they want to fill, and therefore they're going to deploy everything they've got for us to execute whatever mission. And I know that I had an opportunity to hear Oliver North not too long ago, and he pointed out to me that the average IQ of today's soldier is 9 points higher than the average IQ of the average American.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so we have a very intelligent force fielded, and it's directed into a type of special forces. He said, frankly, you'd have to be high school graduate or college even to keep up with the equipment and the technology and to be able to do any of the things that these young people are doing. And so it is a interesting career for them, but they're bright. And so I would much rather have a brighter than average group that is motivated to be there for purposes of protection, rather than, oh, gee, if I can just get through this without getting hurt and get home type viewpoint.
Well, I know about some of that technology. I was in the Navy myself as a young man, I found it fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine what it's like today?
Oh, yeah. I can. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, so I'm proud of them. I'm grateful that they're willing to do that. And but we're a citizen army here, too. We're responsible for the home front, which means we're responsible for the condition of education, the condition of medicine, the condition of our justice system, all of that. And we can do our fighting in a different way, and that's knowledge, awareness, commitment, getting involved.
Lee, we're down to about the last 5 minutes of the program. Perhaps you can get back to the book and talk about it a little bit and tell our listeners where people can get it.
Well, they could certainly go to whitekingrising.com to learn about both books in there, and they could purchase there as well, or go on over to amazon.com. And I've had a very fun time in the last few months as we released the sequel, because the readers, when they're writing in, Walt, when they bother to comment or post reviews or email me or find me in some way, 100% of them have indicated, "Oh, my Lord, I think this is true. I didn't see it before, but now I see it." And they're also calmer. Now, they're suspense novels, so they're pretty scary, because I'm coming through, and the reader has to come through the point of view of the actual, real-life mastermind of Al-Qaeda. And then he encounters this young grandmaster chess champion who's 18 years old when he starts, and then the hero, the second hero, James Michaelis, the CIA analyst, and then the new hero in the new book, Brian Washington Carver, who's a football-playing boy from the hood. So you have a young man who barely made it out of the ghetto, combined with this chess champion, and they figure out how to reverse the line that Zawahiri is running on is so effectively, and turn the tables in such a way that not only will he fail, but any future enemy attacking along that line wouldn't be able to make it. And it rests on Generation Y and what they do. And so I've had such fun revealing that. But it's, you know, it's comforting to know that the reader absolutely gets it, but so are counterterrorist people and the military people. They call me and say, "I can no longer separate fact from fiction. To me, your books seem totally true."
So then at least the politicians have had a chance to read it, and some of the military leaders as well.
I hope so. I hope so. That was my intention, that they get a hold of it, that it gets passed to them. I know it's gone into the counterterrorist community and homeland security types, and I don't know who Hall has read it, and I don't even need so much the credit for that. I would know if I saw them turn in some directions, because they are going to have to handle some things. But it is... I think that I can have an easy discussion with them when they call and say, "Well, how did you figure that out?" I can talk them through my line of logic and reasoning. They've got gifted, talented people and intelligence. If they just pursue some of the creative imagination steps that I took, they'll come up with this. They just have to be willing to face it.
Well, Lee, do you have any intentions of pursuing this as a television series?
No, feature film. And I'm glad you asked, Walt, because I hadn't brought that up, but we're very close to a major motion picture deal now on the first book, because it will make a tremendous film. And everyone who reads both books go, "Oh, my, they read like a house of fire, you know, and they're page turners, and the characters are interesting." And so they will make great movies. But that message then can carry through in there, and people, I think, will see themselves in the story and see where they fit in it. So I'm expecting to have to go back to Hollywood over the course of this next year to be involved with that once a deal is struck. So I'm excited.
And that's not too tough, I guess, once you're an established actress in the... and writer to do that.
Well, to be honest with you, I would not have known how to go where we've gone with this, but I have a very gifted producer manager, and he's very experienced in the industry, so he's been able to take the project to very high levels, and we're very close now to my being able to pick who's going to get the rights to make the movie White King and the Doctor, and then later, of course, there'll be the sequels.
Lee, we're down to our final minutes. Maybe you can give us the website again and let people know how they can get the book.
WhiteKingRising.com. And by the way, if they go there and they order, they'll get an autographed copy, because those orders, when they come through that website, eventually come to me. Of course, they could go to Amazon. They could wander into Borders. But if they want to read about it and see some of the activities that have gone on related to these books, I would encourage them then to go to WhiteKingRising.com.
Well, Lee, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy day to give us a call. Lee Kessler, our guest. And if our listeners have any questions regarding this program, they may address their correspondence to CBS Public Affairs in care of this station. Thanks for listening. I'm Walt Shaw.
Thank you, Walt. It's been great.
Okay, good.
That was fun.
It was fun, yeah. Yeah, we'll go ahead and get that on the air for you. Probably won't run for... I'm about 6 weeks ahead on these shows.
Oh, you are? Okay. I'll make a note of that. That's good.
Yeah. I stay ahead on these programs, and I get so many requests to do them, too. It's I'm on 5 stations, and they're pretty popular programs. So.
Excellent.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Lee.
Thank you. I appreciate being on.
You betcha.
Okay. Bye-bye.